You're listening to Control ClickCast. We inspect the web for you. Today, we're talking about responsive typography with our special guest, Clarissa Peterson. I'm your host, Leia Alcantara, and I'm joined by my fab co-host,
Emily Lewis.
Today's episode is sponsored by Visual Chefs, a versatile web development agency with expertise in content management system and custom web application development. Through partnerships with designers, agencies, and organizations, Visual Chefs propels the web forward. Visit visualchefs.com to learn more. We'd also like to congratulate Pixel & Tonic, our major sponsor, on launching Happy Logger, a personalized craft CMS demo site. So, if you're planning to test craft or show craft to a client, you can use the demo to get a personalized install of the Happy Logger demo site with login credentials and basic information. They've also open-sourced the site on GitHub for those who want a more DIY approach to the demo site. The link to all the info will be in the show notes.
Today, we have Clarissa Peterson on the show to talk about responsive typography. Clarissa is a UX designer and web developer and co-founder of the Montreal-based digital agency Peterson Candy. She is a frequent speaker and gives workshops on responsive design and user experience. Clarissa is also the author of O'Reilly's Learning Responsive Web Design, A Beginner's Guide. Welcome to the show, Clarissa.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So, Clarissa, can you tell our listeners a bit more about yourself?
I live in Montreal. I've lived here about 2 years, but I come from the United States. I've worked in the web field for about a dozen years.
So before we focus on responsive typography, let's talk about general web typography. Leia, as a designer, what are the main tenets of good typographic design?
Well, the bottom line about good typographic design is clarity.
Mm.
To make sure that what you're actually wanting people to understand is readable, and on top of which is attractive.
Mm-hmm.
So the basics, really, like all the rules in graphic design in regards to typography, is to have that balance between clarity and understanding, as well as making it look good.
Mm-hmm.
But making it look good also means that there's a voice and a sort of a brand to mm-hmm. the actual work.
Yeah, it reminds me, I was actually reading an article that's from Opera that was talking about that, you know, we all might be familiar with that flash of unstyled text when
right.
you're loading a site on your mobile phone and it's got a special web font and that web font hasn't rendered yet. So it's
right.
like a default fallback
right.
and how people complain about it, but it's actually a feature. It's a feature so that you can still read the content even without the pretty fonts. It's all about readability.
You know what, though? That sounds like a developer term, right? It's like, it's not a bug, it's a feature.
It's a feature. Well, speaking of development, let's talk to Clarissa and get her front-end perspective. So, Clarissa, what do you think is the most important thing to think about when it comes to typography on a website?
Well, the most important thing with typography is to keep in mind that what you're doing is communicating a message to users or you're allowing them to interact with the site. So if your text isn't easy to read, your users won't stay on your site or they won't come back to your site. So it doesn't matter how pretty your typography looks if
right.
it's hard to read because you're not meeting your goal.
Absolutely. And this to either one of you, have you ever found, I personally haven't, but any kind of tool that lets you know if something's readable? Is there like a standard or a tool that you can utilize?
I think beyond like the accessibility tools, and I think that's more about contrast than it is type specific. And mm-hmm. by contrast, I mean colors and those kind of things versus, say, size comparisons. I'm not really sure there's one where it says, this is more readable.
This is
readable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably one of the harder conversations than you might have then with like a client who's like really sold on a particular font that may not be particularly readable.
But you know, at the end of the day, it isn't just like if we're talking about design terms, it isn't just about the font itself, right? It's a lot of it really is layout related. Like I feel like it's almost, I don't know, maybe I'm taking my design understanding for granted, but if the line length is way too long, like if you had a 1024 site like layout and you've decided that all your paragraphs are going to be 900 pixels wide, that's just intuitively to me unreadable.
I feel the same way, but you and I failed to convince a client of that recently, if you remember.
Yes, that's true. Although I think there was a bit of a balance there because
if I'm thinking of the same client. I think part of it was just the intro paragraph and the headline.
Yeah, it actually got extended to other pages that are taking up full line length. But those are the things that are challenges right.
To try to convey.
Exactly. But it all comes down to those basic tenets that you and Clarissa just mentioned. It's about communication. Are you able to communicate that message? Is it readable? So Clarissa, let's talk about responsive typography. What's unique about responsive typography that front-end devs and designers too need to focus on?
Well, the most important thing to think about is that you have to know how your typography is going to look at every screen size.
Right.
And you can't assume just because it looks good on your desktop that it's going to look good on smaller screens or larger screens or different types of screens.
Is there something that you have done yourself for client projects to kind of test that out, how type looks on different things? Do you, you know, I know for myself, I use Browser Stack really often to take a look at how sites look in different devices and different sizes, viewports. Is there something you do?
Well, you really need to be able to use actual devices because if you're using something like Browser Stack, you're still really looking at it on your desktop screen.
Right.
So it might not be an accurate picture of how it's actually going to look on a certain type of screen.
Good point.
But in regards to that, though, there's a practical end in regards to that. Mm-hmm. Unless you are a giant firm, design firm or whatever, a full-fledged device lab is not really financially viable. How do you get around that?
You don't need to test on every possible device, but you at least need to test on some phone and some tablet. You can't just change the size of your browser window and think that's all you need to do.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that there's a specific, the top five devices that you must have physically, or top three? Like, is there a specific ones that you always make sure that you test physically?
I know that a few people have written about this, and I don't actually know the answer myself, but there are people that there is an answer to that.
What do you personally do?
I don't do a lot of site development, but I mean, I test on my own phone and my own tablet, so I don't have a lot of devices.
What devices do you have?
I have an iPhone and an iPad and an Android phone and an Android tablet.
That probably is going to cover a fair amount of bases. It's kind of what we do, Leah. Between the two of us and our partners, we have a lot of different devices that we can test on.
Yeah, essentially. And we also rely on our clients. You know, at the end of the day, they're testing their site on their devices. So making sure we know what device that they even have. I do believe I read somewhere, might have been Ben Callahan, who suggested just go to your local AT&T. If you must test and you have like a low budget, just go to your local AT&T and just check all the devices while they're out there.
I think that's a good idea. It'd be kind of, you know, kind of awkward, but it probably would completely work. We've gotten in a habit here in this household where I used to recycle my phones, but when we upgrade, we just keep them.
Right.
I have a box, and that box is called my device lab.
Yeah. I always think about that because we sold Rob's iPhone 4S because it's one of the shorter ones. And I thought, okay, do I really want to just keep this or should I get rid of it? It's just like everyone's going to end up with 100 devices. That's a bit weird.
Yeah. It's definitely increases the amount of time. I do want to bring this up before we move on to the next question. I do think this is one of those reasons why it's a good idea to begin your design deliverables being web-based early on.
Right.
'Cause like Clarissa was saying, it's so important to actually see something on a device,
right,
not necessarily relying on Browser Stack or things like that. And that's one of the reasons why one of the deliverables you put together for clients before you get to actual comps is what we call element collage, but it's really like Samantha Warren's style tiles. And we've seen a couple other ones out there. There's one called Web Styles. But basically, it's a way to present some font options or type options to a client and have them actually look at it on the web, on their browser, on their devices, as opposed to a perfect Photoshop anti-alias comp.
Yeah, for sure.
So, Clarissa, what do you think has changed over the years now that responsive and mobile is so important in terms of how people design text from what we used to do?
Well, the way that people used to design websites is you'd use Photoshop and you'd have a specific fixed width, and your design would always be that width no matter what device it was displayed on.
Right.
So with responsive design, you're creating a design that can be viewed at different possible widths. So you have to make sure that your type and the other parts of your design look good at all these possible widths. And that doesn't mean just on phone width or a tablet width. You have to think, you know, you have phones that are 320 pixels wide, But you also have some that are 345 pixels wide or 380 pixels wide that are all going to look slightly different. So you have to be able to have text and other design elements that respond to the width of the screen and still look good at all these different possible widths.
Is there anything that you do in your agency or that your team does to create examples or before it gets to an approved design, those are early stages of the design deliverables, to ensure that it sort of hits all of the points it should? Like something that comes to mind for me, for example, is the actual content you're displaying in a web-based comp. It might look good because the length of those words happens to look good. Do you cycle through different content? Do you do special deliverables?
I guess what we do in my agency is we don't actually do responsive prototypes. We'll just have a couple different screen widths. And then when I do the development, I go in and figure out what it's supposed to look like between those screen widths. So it's really not the best way to go about it, but sometimes that's how you have to work.
I mean, that's kind of how we have done it. We're trying to adjust our processes to find the sweet spot. If you could pick your ideal situation, especially as a developer, what would you want to receive from a designer to make sure that you can develop efficiently?
I think the easiest thing for me would to be able to have a mobile-first design because I develop that way. I start with the narrowest screen width and then add media queries to work up to wider screen width. And I found that it's really hard if I don't if I get comps that weren't designed from a mobile-first mindset, it's a lot harder to develop them that way.
I feel that way too, but I do think, and Leia, chime in, I think it's also because Leia and I work together, I have to be flexible to what works for her.
Right.
And Leia, what works for you these days?
To be honest, I'm still struggling between a desktop versus mobile mindset. With one of our current clients, I've been just doing like mobile stuff first these days, which I really enjoy. But now we're moving into the next phase for this particular deliverable. He's already approved all the mobile views. I'm like, okay, how do I make this expand? Because I think what some people struggle with when they just first get into responsive design is you still are in that fixed width mindset. And the other thing is, it's like responsive design isn't just making everything into percentages and it's just going to be a larger version of the smaller version, because that's going to be disaster. You might actually need to change the layout of what you did in the mobile view and to make it work in a larger screen, because it isn't just something where you just proportionally expand. You also have to think about like how people are interacting with the content in a desktop versus how they're interacting in a mobile view. So I definitely enjoy doing a mobile first, but I still have to think way harder when I'm trying to expand it into other layouts. And I think one of the things that that's a bit harder for me too is that in between, I think, which I'm going to try to do a little bit better, because sometimes I can see the widest view and I can see the smallest view. But then the in-between is where you're like, okay, should I just proportionally expand the smallest view in the in-between? Or is it going to be like a hybrid between that plus what I did in the widest view? So that's where I'm like still struggling. And at the same time, it's just with responsive typography, what proportions need to make sense in that view? And sometimes just choosing a font that works in mobile, I'm trying to figure out, like, does it make sense to keep that size the same throughout if possible, or does everything need to change?
Well, so Clarissa, let's talk first about the basics of that, the sizing of typography. So what kind of units should we be working with for responsive typography? M's, responsive M units, percentages? I'm guessing pixels are a definite no-no.
Right. You don't want to use pixels because they're not responsive at all. They can't change. M's and rems are what you use for fonts, which are relative units. And you start out with a base font size of M for your body text, like paragraphs and lists and that sort of thing, and then go from there. And it's pretty simple. If you're starting with 1M, if you want a headline to be twice as big, you make it 2M. So it's pretty simple to do the math around any of that. And the difference between M's and rems, M's are a little more complicated because they're sized in relation to their containing element.
Right.
So if you have, say, a paragraph inside a div and you give a font size to each of them, those actually multiply. So you might not get the expected results that you're looking for. And it's kind of hard to explain that without showing.
I know exactly what you're talking about. I've done it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've been like, why is this this
like,
size?
Why is this much smaller than I expected?
Right. The key to getting around that is to use sensible CSS and think about how you're writing your CSS, which you should do anyways, and keep things as simple as possible and apply font sizes to elements rather than containers to reduce the number of conflicts. So REMs work a little bit differently in that they all relate back to the root element, so you don't have this issue with conflicts, which, you know, in some ways is good because it makes it a lot easier, but you don't have the same power that you have with M's, because with M's, sometimes you actually do want to apply a font size to containing element and change, say, everything inside a div all at once, which on a responsive site gives you a lot more ability to change things in different places.
Right.
So with REMs, you can't do that. It's more straightforward. But the downside with REMs, though, is that they're not supported in every browser, such as IE8 and older or Opera Mini. So you have to add a fallback in pixels for those browsers or other types of fallbacks to make sure that those browsers are covered, which adds a lot of extra work.
You mentioned a fallback in pixels. Is that what's recommended, or could you do a fallback in just M's?
You could do a fallback in M's and use the same number, but then you'd have this problem with nested elements and things multiplying.
Right, okay.
If you're going to do the fallback in M's, you might as well just use the whole thing in M's.
Right.
Is there any place for percentage values?
You use the percentage value for fonts only in one place, and that's where you set the font size for the entire document, the entire web page. So generally, you're going to start out with a font size of 100%. And what that means, if you're trying to figure out, you know, what font size is that really, by choosing 100%, it sets the font size of 1M, your base font size, to the most appropriate reading size for body text on that particular device. So it's not always the same size. And usually on desktop computers and a lot of tablets and phones now, it works out to 16 pixels. But on some other devices like e-readers, it might be 20 pixels or another number that it works out to, because those screens need a larger text size to be easy to read.
Right.
And especially as we come forward in the future, as there's different device types and interaction models, we don't know how those are going to work. So they might have different text sizes altogether. So by using that 100%, you're ensuring that in these future devices, that's still going to work out to a good reading size, no matter how that device works.
This may seem simple to, I don't know, maybe some of our listeners, but I'm actually not doing this now. And this is the first time it's been explained to me why I shouldn't specify that base font unit in M's. So I'm literally making a note on a sticky note right here for me to implement later today.
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. Although as a designer, it's like, oh God, how much more complicated how we just made our lives.
To me, it seems a lot simpler. I mean, if you're used to pixels, obviously you're used to them. But this way, all you do is start out with 100% and then make your paragraphs and body text 1M and then have everything go up or down from there. So it's pretty straightforward.
Right. It's just a shift. And I think those are the things that are hardest for both designers and developers. You get comfortable doing things the way you've always done them, and doing something new just inherently feels uncomfortable to start with. And so it's getting past that comfort level thing. And kind of, Leah, what you were talking about earlier, how you're trying to adjust how you design,
right?
You know, having particularly that middle place in between the smallest and the largest viewport.
Yeah.
So Clarissa, kind of with that in mind, you as a front-end developer, if someone's coming to you from a mobile-first perspective, does that mean that you just get a comp for a mobile view, or do you get comps for a couple different sizes?
Well, how I work in my agency is we'll have comps for a couple different sizes. But I won't necessarily follow those exactly when it comes to typography or sizes of different things.
Right.
Which I know is, you know, designers think you're going to do exactly what they tell you to do. But what I do, I just start with that 1M for the smallest screen size, because I want that the text to be at least that size, you know, and then I use the proportions from the comp. But then for larger screen sizes, you can actually make your type bigger since you have so much empty space that you can use. So while I might have 1M for my paragraph text on the smallest screen, on tablets it might be 1.1M, you know, on desktops 1.2 or 1.3, depending on what looks good on the screen.
And that's just something you're gauging while you're designing in the browser?
Right, because unless you're doing responsive prototypes, you're not having a picture of how it looks at every screen size. Mm-hmm. So you're having to make little tweaks in between at different sizes. And with typography, you don't need to just have a couple media queries. Like, I know a lot of designers do this. They'll have like a main breakpoint for phones and one for tablets and one for desktop. But with typography, you actually want to add a lot of different media queries where they feel most appropriate, even if it doesn't follow those main breakpoints. Mm-hmm. Because your site, your text needs to look good at all the in-between sizes, too.
Have you ever been in a situation where you need to kind of communicate those choices back to a designer who may have had different font sizes specified?
Not really, I guess.
Leah, what would be the, you know, how would that conversation go, you know, without it being, no, this is how I designed it versus, well, this is how it should be experienced?
I think if you take it that perspective that this will be more readable in mm-hmm. other devices, I think that makes sense. You know, what this does seem to bring up is more and more front-end developers need to put the designer hat on, right? Mm-hmm. Because even if you give all these different comps for the different sizes and you have that perspective, designers seem to need to move away from pixel perfection and have that communicated to the developer. And the developer should also make choices to say like, okay, well, I tried to go as close as possible, but it doesn't really necessarily work, so I'll have to adjust it this way. So I think maybe the way the conversation goes is that everyone understands that there needs to be tweaks.
Yeah, I think one of the flip of that is that I often, at least in our earlier projects together, yeah. Leah, is that I'd get your comps and I would try and make them exact.
Right.
You know, I would try and give you exactly what you gave me.
Yeah.
And I felt, you know, there were times like where I'm designing for the squishy middle,
right.
you know, the various breakpoints that pop up
right.
that just my gut's like, I think something needs to be adjusted. And I would sort of like push back on myself and say, no, you know,
Leah gave you this.
Exactly. So it's definitely more collaboration. It sounds like it feels like at least that's where
we're
going.
I think so. And I think that makes the most sense. At the end of the day, I think I read this article somewhere where the web was never meant to be fixed with. Like, mm-hmm. it never was, even at the dawn of time. And I don't remember who invented it, but was it Ethan Marcotte? Like,
yeah,
I think so. Like, he was way ahead of his time with, let's make all these layouts and all these other things variable. Don't use mm-hmm. pixels. And we were all like, you crazy, you know?
Well, I remember even before Ethan was talking about the responsive web design, but just trying to embrace liquid-based layouts.
Yeah.
You know, that was hard for me.
Yeah, I resisted that for like the longest time. And now it's like, oh, should have listened.
Everything. Yeah, exactly. I should have gotten used to this sooner.
Sure.
So, Clarissa, let's talk about getting text to look at it every screen size. You talked about having those various, you know, not having a fixed mindset of what your breakpoints will be for type, but instead responding to what you're experiencing on the actual site or the deliverable, whatever. Is there anything else that you should adjust with text beyond the M values to make sure that text looks good at every screen size?
Yes. One of the most important things with responsive typography is your line length, which is how many characters on each line of text. And that has a really big impact on how readable the text is. And they've actually done studies to figure out the best line length, and it's 45 to 75 characters. So you don't even need to guess or look at it and try to figure it out. You can just, you know that exactly those number of characters within that range is going to be a good readable line length. Mm-hmm. So this is especially complicated, though, on responsive sites because your line length is going to change since all your page elements are flexible. So you have to look at your site at different screen widths and make adjustments so that it stays within that 45 to 75 character range, no matter what the width of the screen is. And you can do that using media queries to change the margins or change the font size. And you can also use max width to make sure your lines are never longer than 75 characters.
Does line height have any impact on a responsive experience? Should it be factored in beyond the actual font size, but the, what's that called, leading between lines?
Yeah, the line height, it's not as important, but it can affect readability. And you want to have, in general, an average line height of about 1.4, but that also can be flexible depending on the width of the screen. So on a small screen, you can have a little less line height, like 1.3, and then maybe for a wider screen, as your font size gets bigger, you might also want to adjust the line height proportion to maybe 1.5 or 1.6, to give everything a more open look since you have so much extra space on the screen.
Yeah, I would say that in practice, I found this to be true. You know, working for one of our clients, I was designing his blog for mobile and desktop. And initially, he just kind of tried to translate what I had already told him to do in desktop to mobile when we first started. And it looked really odd, even though like it looked totally fine, like the 1.4 looked fine in desktop and all those things. And in the end, I was like, no, we need to change the spacing here, the line height here in my iPhone, because it looks weird. It's interesting that just intuitively, like I feel like design really is like both an art and a science. There's rules to help make things look good. But once you are a designer for several years, you just kind of have that gut reaction when things just look bad, you know?
So aside from these font, let's just call them properties, you know, line height, is there anything with like letter spacing, like between characters? Like I know letter spacing is an available attribute for CSS. Is that something that should come into play when you're adjusting screen sizes?
I've never heard of that having to do anything with responsive design, but that's more of a design thing. So maybe I just don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I've on occasion when I've gotten comp from Leia and I'm working in the browser and how the browser is rendering the font versus what she had given me,
right,
I sometimes will throw letter spacing in there just to open it up a little bit because it's tight. But I agree, Calissa. I've never had an actual, it's related to specifically responsive. It's more just, you know, viewing it on a browser versus a comp.
Well, there are some like traditional print typography rules for the letter spacing. In typography, it's called like kerning. That's the mm-hmm. space between the letters. And there's a general rule if you're going to do small caps and it's going to be a small font, that you want to have a little bit wider letter spacing, because when it's all caps, it looks like it's jumbled, squished together. So like a 1-point letter spacing or like adjusted kerning might make it look more readable. So that's something that, you know, I always consider too when just in general typographic design.
So aside from those kind of properties, what about the actual fonts, Clarissa? How does font choice affect responsive design?
For font choice, one thing to think about is a font that looks good at a large size might not look as good at a small size.
Right.
So for example, something you're using for headlines that looks good on a desktop because you can put it in really big letters, on a mobile phone size screen, you might have that headline in much smaller letters and that font might just not look good at that small size.
Right.
So in that case, you would be best off by maybe switching it a different font for the smaller screen size using a media query.
Right.
And the other thing with font choice is just to think about performance, because if you're using web fonts, obviously however many you use will add to the download time of your site. So you don't want to use tons of fonts if you don't need them, because that's going to make your site slower to some extent. Mm-hmm. And most sites can get by with only 2 to 3 fonts. You know, and just you should think about if you're adding an extra font, do I really need this on here? Is it worth the expense and the loading time?
And I just also want to note that it's not just the different fonts, the different weights of the same font.
And styles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So, you know, Clarissa kind of mentioned how you could have a font that's fantastic for a headline in a desktop because it's large and beautiful, and then you try to put it in a mobile, then it looks really weird. And also maybe it's a huge hit because it's like a headline font. You know, it might be better to use, like, let's say there was an extra bold weight that you're using for the desktop. You could possibly get away with just using the bold weight in the mobile while using the same typeface. So you don't even have to change the font. But on the flip side, adding a new weight adds some speed considerations and weight considerations to the actual page.
Yeah. And this is, you know, not expert talking here. This is just me messing around with some things in the past. So let's take, for example, a third-party service like fonts.com. There's another one called Typekit. There probably are more, but those are the two that come to my mind. So these are ones where you actually pay for the right to use a particular font on your site.
Right.
So fonts.com, we've been using a lot lately because they just happen to have the typefaces that we're using a lot.
Right.
And when I'm picking the font and assigning it to the server, if I choose the extra bold, the italic bold, like all of those add to the size of the file that I'm downloading.
Yeah.
So it's not another font, but it's another, like Leah was saying, more weight to what's being downloaded to for that particular mm-hmm. file.
For sure.
You know, before we talk a little bit more about typography, I wanted to talk a little bit about these sort of services. Leah, you and I have been using it for clients and has not been a particular, I don't know, drawback to them, except we do have one client right now who's very performance aware.
Very much.
Which is awesome.
Yeah.
It's rare to have a client appreciate it that much.
Yeah.
And he's always questioning why we've made a choice to use a given font, or like we use Font Awesome often for icon, vector icons. So what are your thoughts, Leah, about using a service like that versus, you know, installing something on his server and having him just call the font directly from his server?
Well, I think a lot of that is dependent on what is this client's budget and bandwidth. Because like with this particular one, he gets like a million hits. So he's got a lot of pages to serve and a lot of fonts to download into cache and all those kind of things. So, you know, sometimes when you think about third party or your own server, downloading it into your own server, a lot of it is whether you can handle that download. Part of the benefit of using any sort of third party, and you know, for front end, this is like regardless whether this is for fonts, some people decide to download the jQuery library versus citing the Google or Microsoft repository, which is fine. But the pros and cons of that is, well, if it's like right on your server, then your server can call it immediately. If it is a third-party server, then you have to rely on their reliability. And most people tend to use like, you know, a third-party service because they've got massive amount of servers and power. So if everything works, and most likely another website has already cited that third-party service, then most likely that library or that font or whatever might have already been downloaded into their cache. Mm-hmm. So there's no speed hit whatsoever. Right? Like it just seems like it's always been there because it's so ubiquitous using a third party service. However, you know, if you're doing a speed audit of your site, you have to look at all the external calls as well, right? Like you have to kind of balance like how many external calls and internal server assets do you have? And sometimes some internal assets are better if it's spread out into the quote cloud and into other services, and other times not, you know. And the thing is, like, it sounds like everything's perfect when everything works on Google. But on occasion, let's say Google is having some sort of high load, then your site will suffer.
Right.
Even if it's not your server, not your fault, if Google is slow and you're using the Google free fonts, those kind of things, then your site might like hang for a little bit.
And your client won't care that it's Google's fault.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, why is this slow? And the thing about that is there's nothing you can do about that because it's a third party service. If there's something that like you've downloaded it yourself, then you can figure out what you can do in your own, like, you know, tweaking of files and compression and, you know, whatever, kind of like add more hardware to your particular thing, hosting situation to make it work or not. So a lot of it really, you know, I know this is like the most annoying answer, but it's the most honest answer, is it depends.
You mentioned Google's free web fonts.
Right.
And I mentioned fonts.com,
right,
which is paid. In my opinion, and this is not that educated of an opinion, but to me, it really comes down to the cost.
Right.
Does the client want to pay for a subscription or they want something free?
Right.
Do you have a different opinion? Is there one better than the other or one better suited for different scenarios?
A lot of it, I think, is a question about branding. Because part of the reason why someone would go with a free service, which is great, like there's a lot of like equivalent fonts. The thing is, with a free font means it was free service. That means it might not have been a font that's been anti-aliased properly. It might have missing characters. It might not have the proper kerning. You know, those kind of things. Because I could make a Google web font and upload it, you know, and it's free, but it could be full of like character flaws that it might just look good on desktop, but then it's just all messed up in mobile, those kind of things. So that's like one of the cons of like a free service, perhaps. You're kind of like hedging your bets whether a professional actually, you know, created this versus a hobbyist. those kind of things. I'm not saying that free fonts are bad, because there's a lot of super, super professional quality free fonts that we use and have our clients use, but you kind of have to search through them. The benefit of fonts.com or Typekit in regards to these types of things is you do have professionals working on your fonts. Mm-hmm. There's full-time designer, type designers and developers that are making these, and they're constantly tweaking them to be more and more compatible with various devices. They're doing all the testing for you.
Right.
Right.
So, and I think it's probably also worth mentioning, because this has come up a couple of times, but if you're paying for a service, you have support.
Oh,
so if something's right. gone wrong, you send an email and there will be someone on the other end to advise you. That's happened to me a couple times with fonts.com, and I needed some assistance because, you know, it was user error on my part, but it wasn't obvious to me.
Yeah. And I just want to touch on something that I mentioned earlier, is the branding thing, is that when you pay for something, you're actually going to get the real font, not the equivalent. So mm-hmm. like if you really want to use Adobe Garamond, you're going to get Adobe Garamond. You're not going to get rando fake Garamond or, you know, inspired by Garamond. You know, you're going to actually get the original typeface that's been professionally anti-aliased for the screen, mm-hmm. you know, those kind of things. So that's what you're paying for. That's why you're paying for that quality. It's kind of like if you're the New York Times or if you are the New Yorker, for example, which I think they use custom web fonts, you can tell because they're mm-hmm. using custom fonts. Like, it's not a font you can get anywhere else. And that's because branding is important for that particular site.
So, Clarissa, you know, we've talked about some third-party services, and honestly, I can't say right or wrong personally. I've not had actual experience with serving your own fonts versus using a server, that one is better than the other. They both come with their own things to consider. But in general, regardless of how you're serving your fonts, is there anything that we can do as developers to make our web fonts behave more efficiently?
As I mentioned earlier, using less fonts so there's less files to download is the best place to start, and think about really whether you need to use all the different fonts that you might have in a design. In some cases, if you're using a font for something specific like a tagline, you can only download the few letters you need instead of the whole character set. There's ways to do that. So there's different tricks you can do like that to maybe decrease how much you're downloading.
Oh, that's an excellent suggestion. That didn't even occur to me. Just the characters you need.
And another option is you can use system fonts that are already installed on the device.
Right, the classic.
But then you just have to be aware that there's different fonts available on different browsers and different devices. So make sure you figure out one for each device and have them all in your font stack.
Yeah, like you mentioning the use the system fonts, that kind of reminded me how far we've gotten with web fonts, and even the fact that we're discussing this a few years ago, this wasn't even an option. Like, it was just system fonts.
Right.
You know, just everyone gonna use Times New Roman and Arial, right? So Clarissa, while I was looking at your presentation on responsive typography, I saw that hyphenation is now part of CSS, and it's totally news to me. I'm curious to know, like, what other traditional typographic options that used to just be print only, what's new coming up for fonts in CSS?
Hyphenation is available in CSS, but it's not supported in all the browsers yet. You can use it in Firefox, Safari, or IE with the vendor prefix, but not in Chrome or Opera.
Oh.
But that's okay to do that, because hyphenation is an example of progressive enhancement, which means there's things that might not be available to every browser or device, but you can add them on for those where it's available.
Right.
So with hyphenation, if you're on a device that doesn't have hyphenation, that's okay. You're not missing content. You're not missing part of the site experience. But for the browsers that can do hyphenation, it just makes your text look a little bit better.
Yeah, though it's definitely, as a designer, that was an exciting thing for me to see, because I feel like the web is finally catching up to print options that we've had for years. And definitely there is a difference. I think in that article you mentioned, Emily, earlier on, the state of web type from Opera, they have an example of how dramatic it looks to have hyphenation versus not, you know, with all these kind of like empty spaces when you don't have hyphenation, if you decide to justify a paragraph. And mm-hmm. then once you add hyphenation, then you don't have those weird extra spaces. You just have, you know, a nice flowing character, and it looks like a more even looking block.
And when you were first asking about hyphenation, you were also saying, you know, I didn't even know that was available.
Right.
This is just a little shout out to one of my favorite resources, caniuse.com.
Ooh.
It is my favorite. If I need to know if I can use something on the web, this is HTML or CSS. It may even have JavaScript stuff, but I never pay attention to that personally. But caniuse.com, you could type hyphenation in there, and it'll come back to you with what the attribute is that you would use in CSS and where browser support, including mobile device browser support, falls on that particular attribute.
This is the first I've heard of this site. It's pretty awesome.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. No, this is the first time I've heard of it. And it's like live searching too. So I just put HY, and if found the hyphenation.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty nice. Another resource that I just came across this week when we were getting ready for this conversation with Clarissa, and I found it through that Opera Dev article on State of the Web Type. It's from Bram Stein, who wrote the State of Web Type article. He also has a site, stateofwebtype.com, and it basically is, you know, it breaks down what's type and typographic features are supported on the web. And you can do a search, or you can just select from the various ones. And it, again, it's kind of like caniuse.com, but it gives you your browser and version support.
Yay, the web's on its way to become prettier.
All right, so before we finish up, Clarissa, what would be your best advice when considering typography for responsive web design?
I think the top priority is the making sure that your text is readable on every device. Like as I said, if it looks good but it's hard to read, you're not going to do a good job of communicating with your users. And then also make sure you're testing on actual devices to see how your text looks and works on those devices.
I actually, while we were talking, I was doing a quick search just to see if there were any tools that could tell you if there was, if some text was readable. I haven't used this yet, but I'm just mentioning it for our listeners. read-able.com. We'll make sure it's in our show notes. It looks like it's at least recommended by some pretty well-known, respected publications in our industry. So it's at least worth checking out.
Very cool.
Leah, what about you from a designer's perspective? What's your best advice for good typographic design in general? Is it the same thing? Be readable?
Since Clarissa took that, I'm going to go with a different answer. I think most designers and developers will agree with this. If you can test using final content or close to final content, that's the best tip I can get. Because if you're going to be doing any typographic design and you're just using lorem ipsum or whatever, then you're not really understanding what the correct proportions mm-hmm. and correct ways to style things are going to be. Because how much content you're going to have, what size the headlines need to be, all change mm-hmm. if you're going to have super large headlines, or if it's going to be one word headlines mm-hmm. or if it's going to be multiple paragraphs versus one paragraph. You make different font choices if that's the case. You make different spacing and sizing choices if that's the case. So if you can get closest or most appropriate content to test your typography with, I think that's my best advice.
I got to throw a follow-up question in this. Does that change at all? There are all these people making these versions of lorem ipsum, yeah. like zombie lorem ipsum and cupcake lorem ipsum. Does that change it because those have different words in the mix that are generated, or is it that's still not the best option?
I would say it's still not the best option. It makes it more fun for you as a designer. Like it's less boring because everyone sees the lorem ipsum and things like that. But we've had, I feel like, enough conversations with clients who are like, what does this mean? It's in a foreign language, you know, to know that, well, you know, let's just avoid that conversation altogether. Now, this is not always ideal. Like, for example, when we're just in our element collage stage or the style tile state, then I am just going to be using
lorem ipsum.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just so they can see the type first and foremost. And it might not necessarily be in the right context quite yet. But I feel like the more you understand the content you're going to be designing for, the better, you know, choices you're going to make in general, not just for readability, but for design, like, because type has a voice, type has a feel. So figuring all those kinds of things out in context based on the content will give you better tools to work with.
Absolutely. It just does sort of present the challenge that comes up every single time where the client's like, oh, but I don't want that word. Let's change the word. And we're like, we're not in that phase right now.
Yeah.
We're focused on design. So can you ignore that, please?
Well, because even adding one word or removing a word can change the headline, right? So for example, a very, very common thing is, okay, we designed this so the headline will stay on one line, not two, because it pushes the paragraph lower. So now you've got a three-column design where one column is longer than the other, you know, those kind of things. But if you decide like ahead of time, or you know what the content is ahead of time, and you know there's going to be a two-line headline, then that's what you're going to design for.
Well, I think that brings us to the end of our questions about responsive typography.
And that leads us to our rapid fire 10 questions, so our listeners can get to know Clarissa a bit better. So are you ready?
Okay.
All right. So the first question is Android or iOS?
iOS.
If you were stranded on a desert island and can only bring three things, what would you bring?
I really have no idea.
All right. What's your favorite TV show?
I don't watch a lot of TV. I'm sorry. I can't think of anything.
All right. What's your favorite dessert?
Chocolate.
Good answer. What profession other than your own would you like to attempt?
I used to be a restaurant manager. I really like doing that.
Is there a profession you would never want to try?
I think I would do pretty much anything. I don't think there's anything I'm opposed to.
What's the latest article or blog post you've read?
I read a lot of stuff. I like to read A List Apart. I try to read all the articles on that.
Okay.
Great resource. Great resource. If you could have a superpower, what would it be?
I don't know. I think I would like to be able to fly.
What music do you like to work to?
I like it to be very, very silent when I work. Having any noise in the background, I can't get anything done.
And last question, cats or dogs?
Dogs.
All right. So that's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us, Clarissa.
Thank you for having me.
In case our listeners want to follow up with you, where can they find you online?
My website is clarissapeterson.com.
Okay, great. Thanks again, Clarissa. This was a fun topic.
Yeah, thank you.
We'd now like to thank our sponsors for this podcast, Visual Chefs and Pixel and Tonic.
And thanks to our partners, Arcus Tech, DevOT, and EE Insider.
We also want to thank our listeners for tuning in. If you want to know more about ControlClick, make sure you follow us on Twitter at ControlClickCast or visit our website, ControlClickCast.com. And if you liked this episode, please give us a review on Stitcher or iTunes or both.
Don't forget to tune in to our next episode when we'll be talking about fighting CMS spam with Greg Aker. Be sure to check out our schedule on our site, controlclickcast.com/schedule, for more upcoming topics.
This is Leah Alcantara
and Emily Lewis
signing off for Control Click Cast. See you next time.
Cheers.